The date is April 7th, 1995, and we're watching Bad Boys. Welcome to I Used to Like This One.
Hello and welcome to I Used to Like This One, the show where we take a look back at movies we remember fondly from our childhood and attempt to look past the nostalgia to see if they still hold up. My name is Sean Wells, and with me is the Marcus Burnett to my Mike Lowry.
Hello, I'm Colin Stewart.
And this week we continue honoring black performers in films as it is Black History Month, and we've brought in another guest, someone who has been on our show before, but not since episode 5, The Last Starfighter, when we were still kind of figuring things out, but Kingsley Leung. Kingsley, welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks, guys. Appreciate being called back. I love it. It's my second tour of duty.
Tour of duty, and we've got a very different kind of movie for you. What kind of experience do you have with Bad Boys? Because you came on for Last Starfighter because you wanted to revisit this old sci-fi movie, and now we've got our buddy cop movie. So, yeah, what kind of history do you have with Bad Boys?
Well, first of all, I mean, you can't go through life, especially when you were born, you know, during our times, right? When you were like raised in the 90s, 80s and 90s, you can't go one second without recognizing bad boys, what you gonna do? Right? I mean, it's an iconic song.
It is. Yeah. Were you a cops watcher?
I was.
You were? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. That's another reason. I think that they kept it alive, right?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Did cops come before or after the movie?
Cops came before.
Before, okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, it ran for, what, like 15 years or something like that?
Yeah.
It ran for a ridiculously long time.
Yeah. I think my real pull towards that movie is, you know, growing up, one of my favorite actresses was Taya Leone.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
I know that crush well. Her legs in this movie, oh my god, like she's got the most incredible legs in that miniskirt. So this week we are looking back at April 1995 when the movies in theaters were A Goofy Movie, Major Payne, Dolores Claiborne, Tommy Boy, and of course our movie for today, Bad Boys, which earned $141.4 million on a $23 million budget.
Man, I love A Goofy Movie. I was probably too busy watching that to watch this movie at the time.
So, more age appropriate.
Yeah. So if you're like me and you watch this movie for the first time right now, or if you haven't watched it yet, then please remember there will be spoilers going forward. So if you don't want the movie to be ruined for you, just hit pause, go watch it, and then come back and hear what we have to say.
The tagline that appears on the poster for this movie is, "What you gonna do?" That's so all there is.
So true.
That's apropos.
That really doesn't describe this movie. So let's go to Colin for a 60-second synopsis.
All right. Well, I mean, it's already been repeated 3 times, but as Kingsley said, bad boys, what you gonna do when, say it with me now, $100 million worth of heroin is stolen from the Miami PD evidence lockup, buddy cops Mike Lowry and Marcus Burnett are put on the case. Their mission? Figure out who pulled off the heist before their department takes the fall. Their investigation leads them to multiple car chases, bathroom brawls, and a whole lot of ether. Through it all, thanks to a case of mistaken identities, Mike and Marcus must learn to walk a mile in each other's shoes to keep Julie, their sole witness, alive and cooperative long enough to identify the mastermind behind the heist and the murder of Mike's prostitute friend, Max. And that is your 60-second synopsis.
Awesome. That's a good one. That's a good one. So, you said in your opening there, watching it for the first time, you've never seen this movie?
Yeah, so ironically, I've seen Bad Boys 2 because it came out when I was in like junior high.
Okay.
I'm going to say it.
And I was really big into Nelly. And I don't know if you guys remember, but at the time for Bad Boys 2, the theme song was Shake Your Tail Feather.
Oh, yes. Right? That's right.
With Nelly, P. Diddy, and Murphy Lee. And that was like the biggest song of the year.
Yeah.
And basically the impetus for me watching Bad Boys 2. But It's a world before streaming services, and I think I've mentioned this before, but like I come from the middle of nowhere, and there wasn't a lot of video stores, so I didn't really have even the ability to go back and watch Bad Boys.
Yeah.
And then I just never really got around to it after that. Like, so this did end up being the first time I watched it, and I really liked it. It wasn't, yeah. In certain ways, it wasn't what I thought it would be. I also don't even really remember much of Bad Boys 2, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still, I mean, the Michael Bayness of this movie is just off the charts.
Off the charts. Big time.
Explosion.
And the slow motion and like the low hero angles looking up at them. Oh, yeah.
Just... And the hot sax music.
Yep.
It's always playing.
Well, here we go. Let's jump into Bad Boys, directed by, like Colin just said, Michael Bay. He actually makes his feature film debut with this movie. He does go on to direct things like Transformers, Pearl Harbor, The Rock, Bad Boys 2. But before this, he was a big-time music video director for artists like Meat Loaf, Lionel Richie, Tina Turner, Wilson Phillips, Vanilla Ice, Young MC, Styx, Chicago, and there were still others outside of that list. That is, like, the most batshit crazy random list.
That actually makes a lot of sense. A lot of the reviews I read that were critical of this movie said it looked like a two-hour music video.
I suppose so, yeah, because, like, Meat Loaf being on that list, I know the I Would Do Anything for Love was one of his. And I remember how epic that music video was.
Yeah, it's huge.
It's produced by our old friend Jerry Bruckheimer, who we talked about in Con Air. He's the producer behind things like Pirates of the Caribbean, Beverly Hills Cop, Top Gun, CSI, Amazing Race, Lucifer, and Confessions of a Shopaholic. I found that kind of fun.
Departure.
Yeah. Also produced by Don Simpson, who is behind Days of Thunder, The Rock, Beverly Hills Cop, Top Gun, Dangerous Minds. And it's written by Michael Barry and Jim Mulholland, who have identical credit lists. Like, I actually got confused while I was taking my notes. But they have credits like writers on The Late Show with David Letterman and The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, plus the Oscars and Oscar the Movie, Amazon Women on the Moon. And it's also written by Doug Richardson, who has only 5 total writing credits. This, Die Hard 2, Money Train, Welcome to Mooseport, and Hostage. And so we open on, and I don't know, is this a Michael Bay trope? Some very yellow filtered establishing shots. Like, does he tends to like find a color palette and just stick with it.
Yeah.
Doesn't he? Yeah.
Yeah, it seemed pretty like, I don't know. And that's also very 90s, that opening on the kind of like cityscape, like
blend into the vehicles kind of and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
But the choice of yellow, it feels so much more science fiction. Like Blade Runner 2049 was very yellow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe he was trying to go like futuristic for the 90s. He was like ahead of his time.
Oh, I was definitely tracking some of the 90s tech that we that we see in this movie.
Yeah, to me, my takeaway from it was like he's just telling me that it's hot, like it's hot out. I need to remember we're in Florida now.
You need
it's
to hot. Feel like you're on the sun. We see a Porsche cruising down the street. The people riding in the car are bickering like an old married couple. These are our protagonists for this movie, our bad boys, and riding shotgun, complaining about the lack of sex at home and eating to the chagrin of the driver is Marcus Burnett, played by Martin Lawrence, who is in all 3 Bad Boys films. Martin, Big Mama's House, Wild Hogs, Rebound, Black Knight, House Party. The driver of the car is Mike Lowry, played by Will Smith, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, Men in Black, it's Will Smith. This apparently, though, Mike Lowry could have been played by Arsenio Hall or Lawrence Fishburne, I read. Like he said, Arsenio Hall says that his biggest regret is turning down this part.
That's so weird. I cannot see Arsenio Hall doing the part of Mike Lowry. I just can't.
No.
All I see is Coming to America.
That's the only thing I know him for, like his talk show and Coming to America. That's Yeah.
I definitely can't see Lawrence Fishburne.
No, definitely not. But well, he'd be a really smooth, like he'd almost be like a Billy D. Williams type. Like he'd be a smooth Mike Lowry.
Yeah.
I also read that this was originally written as a Dana Carvey, John Lovitz movie.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
That's crazy.
And Dana Carvey didn't get along with one of the people, like one of the production assistants or something. And so he backed out completely. And then they're like, okay, well, they sold the property to Touchstone and then jazzed it up a bit. And then I read at one point it could have been Eddie Murphy and Wesley Snipes as well. Which,
oh, that would have been sweet.
Right?
That could have worked.
Well, these two are razzing each other's lines, like calling Mike's car a shiny dick with two chairs in it. But at this point, Marcus spills some food, and this makes Mike pull over to yell at Marcus a bit. But while this exchange is happening, another car pulls up behind them. A hot woman gets out of the car to walk in front of the Porsche as a distraction, while two armed assailants come up to the window to carjack them. They tell the carjackers that they definitely chose poorly today because they're trying to jack two cops, to which the carjacker responds, "Yeah, and I'm a comedian." And I love Marcus's line to Mike of, "Why do I always get the thick motherfuckers?" They take out the carjackers, and with a gun pointed at him, Mike says, "Now let's hear one of those jokes, bitch." And this scene ends up being kind of like a cold open because now the real story starts. This was just kind of establishing the characters, giving a little taste of our heroes. And I read that this was filmed a couple weeks after production had wrapped because they decided they wanted a new opening for this movie.
That scene taught me that, like, I will never... It reminds me of Jurassic Park, how the velociraptors hunt. You know how, like, the one comes at you from the head and then the two grab you from the side?
Yeah.
And so if I'm ever in traffic and a hot girl comes across the front, I'm like, this scene has taught me I need to be aware
of my surroundings.
Head on a swivel, man. Head on a swivel. Yeah, totally.
Chameleon eyes.
Yeah. So we get some more yellow tin shots of Miami with credits over it, and day turns to night, and we cut to the inside of what looks like an armored car with a group of bad guys in it, and we get a conversation with the one guy standing by the back door dressed as was he a cop or a security guard?
I think he was a security guard or something.
Yeah, see, he looks like he's dressed as an armored car guy, maybe, but not an actual cop.
Yeah.
But he is mentioning that he's the decoy before getting shot in the head by bad guy Fouché. And this guy is played by, I had to look up the pronunciation, Cheeky Kai Ryu. It's spelled like T-C-H-E-K-Y and then K-A-R-Y-O. Cheeky Kai Ryu, or... Yeah, see, I spelt it out phonetically in my notes, and I still can't get it. He's from movies like Taking Lives, The Core, The Patriot, GoldenEye, Saving Grace, and Nikita, and a whole bunch of French movies. I slipped Saving Grace in there because that's this like little independent movie about this little old lady that decides to start growing pot because her husband dies and like doesn't have life insurance or something like that. And it's like a little British movie. I love it, so just slip that in there.
I thought it was like the TV show. Wasn't there like a medical drama of some sort called Saving Grace?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
That's right.
So the decoy lives up to his name and does just that, falls out onto the street dead, and Fouché calls the cops to report the dead cop. The Miami PD pull out all the stops, including a police helicopter. For what? The 911 call was so brief. And, like, he gave no description of who they'd be looking for or anything. Why are they busting out a chopper?
I don't know.
Because that's what you do in Miami.
Yeah, it's your first line of defense. Yeah.
But getting the police helipad clear was part of the plan, because now we get the bad guys breaking into a police precinct via the roof. A very well-executed plan involving night vision goggles, switching video feeds, climbing through vents, and breaking into the evidence vault and liberating a whole bunch of heroin from lockup, which they get out of there using a super fast sled through the tunnel. How much fun does that sled look?
That looks awesome.
I totally do it.
Yeah, because they have to escape themselves, and so they climb onto this sled as well to get out of there. Man, just looks so much fun, this little rocket sled. So we see one guy in the truck slip one of the packets into his own bag in the truck, and then they're out of there. Heist successful. So we cut to morning and an alarm going off. This is Marcus's house with his wife lying all up on him. You know, like, good for him that after all these years of marriage, they still wake up cuddling. because like that feels like something that usually dies out after the first couple months of dating someone.
Wow, that's sad for you, Sean.
So his wife, Teresa, who is played by Teresa Randall, who was in Spawn, Space Jam. She played Michael Jordan's wife in Space Jam. Malcolm X, Jungle Fever, all the Bad Boys movies. She asks if he had good dreams, to which, of course, he points out his boner. He tries to get a little before work nookie, except the kids burst in to be a wet blanket. And then Mike shows up for breakfast, and we get a glimpse of his playboy lifestyle and that he is definitely not the best influence around the brunette children, as they ask about his date the night before. And the phone rings. Teresa answers it, and it's for Mike for some reason.
What?
I didn't even notice that.
Yeah, I didn't notice that either.
Yeah, she answers the phone call, and she says, Mike, it's for you. And so it's Mike that has to answer the call from the captain yelling at them to get their asses into work. But yeah, wow. She says, Mike, it's for you. So it's like, are they that enmeshed in their lives that he's always there? And like, yeah.
They just seem pretty tight.
They don't really actually explain a lot about like Mike and Marcus's history, I noticed. They kind of allude to certain things, but
yeah,
some stuff like kind of contradicts other stuff, but I'm assuming it seems like they kind of grew up together and ended up becoming police together. But
yeah, but isn't it interesting though, Colin? Isn't it interesting that after you finish watching the movie, you get the sense without even them telling you that they obviously were really tight, they're really close, and their lives have meshed for a really long time, even though they didn't tell you that.
Yeah,
right? But they did a good job. Obviously, they did a great job to kind of give you that impression, right?
But their relationship would really make you feel the opposite. Like, some of it feels like it goes above breaking balls. You know, like, some of it seems really mean.
Well, it's almost like a brother relationship, right? To me, they group together, but it's like they were two brothers. Like, and obviously Will Smith plays maybe the younger, kind of like naughty, you know, degenerate brother.
Yeah.
Right. Living the cool lifestyle, single lifestyle where, you know, his older brothers, you know, settle down, wife, kids, you know, mm-hmm. trying to set off on a good path. I don't know.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting that Mike's, like, the bit of his backstory that you do get is that he's a trust fund kid.
Yeah.
It's just not really, the type of backstory you'd expect for, like, a black cop
in the 1990s.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think the time of the movie was perfect for that, not only just the casting, but the storyline, right? Like, Will Smith was starting to become like this major movie star. And so this role would have been, it's perfect for him in this explosive movie, right? Just in the time, the 90s, black people in general were not really as visible, but they were starting to be, right? So I think this really elevated their presence in the movies.
Was this Will Smith's like first major movie role after Fresh Prince?
I'd say, wasn't Independence Day 94? Or was that 90? Oh, no. Independence Day is 96. And Independence Day is 96,
I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It might have been.
I think this kind of launched him. I think this launched him into basically like as a major movie
superstardom.
Yeah.
Because afterwards, didn't he do like stuff like Wild Wild West or something like that?
Well, yeah. But luckily, he had Independence Day and and Men in Black before Wild Wild West, I think.
Yeah. He did have like a little bit of a lull, but.
Yeah.
Because right after Wild Wild West, I think he did Ali. And even though like
people didn't really
like that movie, I think it was kind of like received well critically.
I think iRobot was before. So these two, they arrive at the precinct where they find out all the heroin from their recent career bust has been stolen. Captain Howard is livid, and he is played by Joe Pantoliano, who we talked about back in episode one, The Goonies, also in Memento, The Matrix, The Fugitive, and The Sopranos. Not only has all the heroin been stolen, but it has to have been an inside job. The theory is confirmed by the presence of Allison Sinclair, from Internal Affairs, who is played by, man, all these tough names in this movie. Marg Helgenberger, who is in Species, Erin Brockovich, currently on All Rise, but probably best known for her 13 seasons as Catherine on CSI. They assure her they'll get the dope back, but at this point, the timer on the case has pretty much started. In the captain's opinions, they have 72 hours to get it back before the FBI and DEA take over. And he also assigns a couple of detectives they have a rivalry with, Ruiz and Sanchez. And so they start with informants. First, Jojo, played by Michael Imperioli.
Imperioli.
Yes. Who, he's from The Sopranos, guys. We know who he is if you watch The Sopranos. He has no information, and they go to a boxing gym to talk to Maxine Logan, the hooker, who is played by model Karen Alexander, who only has one other acting credit. She plays brainwashed hooker in the movie, Replicator. You want to hear the synopsis of this movie?
It's intriguing.
Do I ever?
Army experimentation with transporter devices accidentally turns people into alligators. It has a 2.5 out of 10 on IMDb, no Metascore. The big star of this movie is Gunnar Hansen, who played Leatherface in the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So that is the star power attached to this movie, is Leatherface.
Yep. you know who else was on this that made a brief star appearance was, for any Edmonton Oilers fans, Marty McSorley,
absolutely.
I read that after the fact, like while I was going through the cast, but I couldn't pick out who he was. Like I was trying to think which goon he was.
Yeah, he was I remember they showed like a hockey helmet laying on some table next to Marcus's bedside table or something, or
yeah,
okay.
You can see Martin McSorley's side profile for a second.
There is also a former Detroit Pistons player in this movie as well. I forget his name right now, but it is in my notes for later on. But yeah, he's the hacker later on.
Interesting.
So they get information from work about who has had the contract for air conditioning upgrades, thinking that that's how they would have had access to the plans to the building. They head to the home of the contractor, and when they get there, take some liberties with proper police procedure to gain access to the domicile, looking in windows and accidentally, in quotation marks, tripping and landing on the door handle, and of course the classic line of "Don't be alarmed, we're Negroes," with Marcus telling him that he has too much bass in his voice. "We want to borrow a cup of sugar?" So
I love that term.
Cute.
He's like, yeah, you have to talk like one of them.
Well, announcing their arrival doesn't really matter because the occupant of the house has been brutally murdered. He sold the blueprints, got rich, and got dead. And Marcus is really disturbed by dead bodies, which is why he works narcotics, not homicide. There were times that Martin Lawrence kind of annoyed me in this movie. And I don't know, there was something about this scene where it's just like a lot of the stuff he did just kind of pushed me over the edge of my tolerance for Martin Lawrence.
Yeah, it's his comedy style, right? It's just his comedy style, just to go over the top.
Yeah. And like even a lot of his interactions with like his wife and stuff like that, it just, there's so much of it where it's like, "Oh my god, just spit it out." So we get another brief scene of them driving and breaking each other's balls a bit. Marcus is driving slow enough to drive Miss Daisy. We also get a little character development from Mike finding out that he comes from family money. And then they sing Bad Boys together. I do want to say that Martin Lawrence is also terrible at pretending how to drive. Yeah, he's one of the guys that wiggles his hands up and down. It's like, you would be swerving back and forth across the road. Like, come on.
Wait till the end of the movie.
Yo, I know. In the
Porsche.
Well, and in the truck too. But yeah, I mean, you know, here's my rant about people not being able to pretend how to drive on screen. You don't need to move your hands that much, people. It's kind of like my video game rant the last time we had Kingsley about people not knowing how to play video games. See, it's a circle. It is.
Absolutely. I like it.
So we cut to Maxine with her madam asking if she's heard of anyone out there who is new money and asking for ladies to party with. Well, as a matter of fact, there is a guy who has been doing just that. And she offers the job to Maxine and tells her to bring her roommate friend because why not? Is her friend an escort? Like, is Julie actually an escort? Because I was under the impression that she's not. She's just the roommate.
She's a photographer.
Yeah. Well,
an employed photographer. I thought that was weird as well. Like, the idea that you work as a prostitute and that your friend would just be open to tagging along, or I don't know, maybe they're just some sort of, like, non-sexual escort. Like, they're just
party girls who just...
Yeah. It's like girlfriend experience.
I don't know.
Girlfriend experience girls.
Yeah. It just, yeah, because you're putting yourself in a situation of there's probably going to be something happening. Yeah. I'm assuming she's not just a party girl.
Yeah. I just find it hard to think, like, if I'm Julie, that I would just be, oh, yeah, like, we could just, yeah, I'm down for a three-way, and then we can go off to the club and be on our way.
Right?
That's what people did in the 90s.
I guess. It was different times.
Things were looser.
So Maxine arrives at the address with her friend Julie Mott, who is played by Tay Leone, as we mentioned in the beginning. Kingsley really perked up there.
One thing I thought was funny that I read was that Tay Leone's real name is Taya. It's like Taya Marie Pantaleone. So I was like, I wonder if Joe Pantaleone kind of... It's spelled differently. I had to make sure that they weren't related somehow. But
he's Pantaleano.
Pantaleano.
That's right. Yeah.
But Tay Leone is from movies like Jurassic Park 3, Deep Impact, Spanglish, Fun with Dick and Jane, and of course, she is Madam Secretary. And the host of this little drug and hooker fueled shindig is Eddie Dominguez, played by Emmanuel Zaareb. His last name is spelt XUEREB. That was another one where I had to look up the pronunciation.
I was going to say Gesundheit. Sound like he sneezed.
Zaareb. Yeah. From movies like Natural Born Killers, The Cowboy Way, Stonewall, plus a whole bunch of TV. Well, Eddie is the guy who had pocketed himself a packet of heroin, which is why he's in such a party mood. Turns out the other thing about Eddie is that he is an ex-cop. We've been introduced to our inside man. And the girls show up to this one-man party at the Al Capone suite he has rented out. Max, in an aside, assures Julie that they'll be there 10 minutes tops while sipping her champagne. And Julie takes a sip from the same champagne glass, which comes in handy later, knowing that, making such a big deal about them both drinking out of the same glass. And she says, make it 5, before excusing herself for the bathroom. So that little exchange right there, though, tells me that she's not actually a hooker. Because otherwise she'd be like, well, how much money is this guy paying us, right?
Sure. Yeah.
So once she's out of the room, Fouché and some of his thugs come in. Fouché has realized he's missing 2 keys of heroin from their heist. And then things turn creepy and sinister as Fouché sees Max and asks her to model for him, which, yeah.
Not creepy.
Yeah, but this creepy moment is very easy to predict moment that she gets shot and killed, falling through a glass table, and then in a moment that is just as expected, also shoots and kills Eddie for his dope theft.
I didn't understand the importance of shooting her through the pillow.
Yeah.
Like, they're not that far away, and it's not like they were trying to silence the shots. It didn't seem like it. It seemed like such a weird choice.
Well, was he trying to just hide it? Like he didn't want to surprise her? Like, so, yeah. Boom!
He gets off on the surprise aspect, yeah. Because they don't use the pillow for Eddie, do they?
No,
they just shoot him.
Yeah, and they don't know that someone else is in the house. So, like, they're hiding it from the neighbors, I guess? Who knows?
It's also important to remember that they're in the Al Capone suite.
Yeah.
They repeat that, like, 4 times.
Yeah. And later on, though, I also think that we see these bad guys with silencers, too. So, I mean, it's not like they don't have the technology already owned.
Yeah. Maybe he just wanted to shoot with some flair.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm pretty sure even in this scene, when they chase Julie after she jumps in the pool, there's a point where they're, like, shooting through people in a cafe. So they don't seem overly concerned about being, you know, stealthy or... quiet.
Well, that's not in this one. That one is the one that's a bit later, is when when Marcus rescues her from the apartment. That's when they go down onto the street.
Yeah,
But still, yeah, they've definitely got no problem just shooting things up. But yes, they see Julie. They chase her. She escapes by jumping in the pool. It looks like it's the shallow end, though, to me, because they've got the stair, the end that she jumps into. They've got the stairs leading down into it, and it's like four steps leading to the base of the pool. So
that could have killed her more.
Yeah,
head first, broke neck.
The deep end is usually a ladder, not stairs. This is a very risky maneuver, Julie.
I also kind of thought it was crazy. When she looks down, it doesn't seem as far of a jump. But when she does jump, it looks to be at least four stories.
Oh, yeah.
It's a very long fall. Yeah.
That Al Capone suite is huge. So we cut to a little later. The Al Capone suite is now a crime scene being processed. I'm not quite sure why narcotics is there. Like, is it simply because of that one little scrap of foil that they found on the scene? Is that the only reason why Mike and Marcus have been invited to this little crime scene party?
Never thought of that.
I don't know.
Yeah, because, I mean, like, on top of that, I imagine Fouché has, like, taken the remainder of the heroin with him. So I doubt there's any drugs on the scene, but we've got a gloveless Mike and Marcus poking around a bit, and they point out all the bullet holes in the wall in the upper levels and the fact that there's two shades of lipstick on the glass. It looks like Beirut up there is what they say about all the bullet holes. And then the first person to see Max's corpse is Marcus. So I know she looks very Sleeping Beauty in this moment, but why is Marcus's reaction to a dead body so inconsistent from what we saw before? Like, is it just because it's a fresher dead body?
Yeah, no, there's no smell, no rotting.
Yeah, exactly. No maggots. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mike comes over, also sees Max, and now he's bummed out. Marcus catches up to him, leaning on his car, and we get some very reminiscent of Lethal Weapon saxophone music playing, just like Colin mentioned at the beginning, a nice Michael Bayism.
It's not quite as epic as the sax man in The Lost Boys, though.
No, definitely not. But no, that was Richard Donner, though.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's right. But yeah, Marcus is asking if he's okay and all that. Mike says he's fine and needs to go check something out on his own. And so the stop he's making is to the madam's house to find out the information about Max's client. It turns out he isn't the only one that has thought of this loose end, because one of the bad guys is in the house with a sledgehammer. Suspicious about the front door that is partially ajar, Mike radios for backup. He gets attacked and thrown through a window by the bad guy in the house, but fortunately the distant sound of the backup sirens scare the perp away. Oh, close call for old Mike Lowry.
I didn't understand the thug's reasoning in not just shooting him
and running away.
It was one of those bad guy moments where I'm like, just kill him. It's like,
yeah, it's I had one of those later Scott on Evil. Too.
Scott yeah. Evil, where I'm just like, you have a gun, you can shoot him right now.
So at the station, Marcus and Captain Howard are there when the phone on Mike's desk rings. The captain answers it. It's Julie, and she wants to speak to Mike Lowry. She won't speak to anyone else, so the captain forces Marcus to pose as Mike, even though he's trying to get home for some long overdue quality time with his wife. Oh, poor Marcus and his blue balls. And, of course, even though these guys have been partners for years and friends even longer, and working in narcotics, have probably done some undercover work in their time, I don't understand why he does such a piss poor job of imitating Mike.
Well, I don't even, like,
further to that, I don't even understand why he has to imitate Mike.
Right!
Because she doesn't know who Mike is. And I was like, why is he being so cautious? Like, why doesn't he want to do it? You're a cop, you should just be like, oh yeah, we have the opportunity, let's do it.
Yeah, and this whole plan that they set up is just banking on the fact that she's never met Mike. So, like, yeah, it doesn't matter what you put out there. I imagine the only thing she knows about him is that he's black, if that. Yeah. You know, like,
I mean, yeah, when they decide to keep the charade going was even more nonsensical to me.
Yeah.
Like, why couldn't you just be like, oh, hey, yeah, I lied because we needed to keep you safe. Here's the real Mike, and then let's move on. Like,
but then it wouldn't be a funny story.
Yeah, like, I guess. It turns into a Three's Company episode is what it turns into, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think for a large part of this movie, you have to suspend your disbelief that they're actually cops.
Yeah.
Because what kind of cops make it to their level? When they're doing all these shenanigans.
Well, yeah, because they're sergeants. Like, they're not even detectives. They're sergeants.
Oh.
The one thing I also kept thinking about was, what is the dress code of this police department? Is anybody in uniform?
Yeah.
Do we just roll around in t-shirts? And
well, the whole precinct itself seems like just such a bizarre mixture of rooms, too. Like, that's something I think of later. There's an interrogation scene later that I'll bring up, but it's just like, these rooms don't even seem like regular precinct rooms.
It was nothing like, you know, I used to watch Miami Vice, and, you know, you go into the cop stations or police stations, very different than what we saw in Bad Boys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I was beginning to wonder whether we were in Miami or whether we were in Gotham City. So Marcus does go to pick her up, though, posing as Mike Lowry. And at her apartment, Marcus knocks on the door. She makes him hold up his badge to the peephole. And then when he comes in, she's like, oh, hell no. And you're not how she described you. And she comes at him with a baseball bat. Or like, or maybe is it because he's done like a shit job of seeming sincere? Yeah, because when he's out in the hallway, he's like, it's Mike Lowry. Like,
yeah, why? I didn't understand that. Why does he have to be so enunciate so much?
Yeah.
Mike Lowry. Lowry. Yeah.
Because I'm Mike Lowry.
But you know what, guys? That bat, well, you know, that's a Louisville Slugger, and I think it's time for Sponsorship Corner. So always on the lookout for product placements in movies. Oh boy, do we have another doozy this week. Bad Boys is brought to you by Louisville Slugger, Porsche, Volvo, Ford, Chevrolet, Land Rover, and Toyota, Sunbank and Citibank, the Detroit Tigers and the Miami Heat, Nike, Adidas, Spalding, and Health Rider Sports Equipment, AT&T, IBM, CBS, Evian, Coca-Cola, Minute Maid, and Sprite, Arm & Hammer Baking Soda, Crisco, Scope Mouthwash, Ivory Soap, Pert Plus, and Denorex Shampoo, Budweiser Beer, Jim Beam Bourbon, and Kamchatka Vodka, just to continue my little trend of hard-to-pronounce names here, Life Cereal, Craftsman, Philips Light Bulbs, DARE, Drug Abuse Resistance Education, and, ironically, heroin. Plus, to the Mike and Marcus's gunpoint requests, they're not actually shown, but a special shout out to Tropical Fruit Bubblicious and Skittles. And this has been Sponsorship Corner.
Did they have to pay for any of this movie?
Well, a bunch of the things that I read, though, is that there were a bunch of budgetary problems on this movie, and it's just like, well, was it all to pay for sponsors or like pay for permission, or was it actually sponsored and that's the only place the budget came from? I don't know. So Julie has come at Marcus with a baseball bat and he has evaded and disarmed her. He tells her that the bad guys will be able to find her, and so they gots to get out of there. I'm not sure why he makes this logic leap. Julie, isn't she just a roommate, right? Like, we've established she's just a roommate here, probably, right?
Yeah. Well, she's basically, like, squatting, kind of. She's, like, a long-term guest.
I guess so. But she wouldn't be in the Madam's books at all. But, like, at the same time, if they follow the trail of breadcrumbs to Max's apartment, why does the madam have her address to begin with? Like, it's not like there's an HR department that keeps track of this shit. Yeah, I was gonna say. Emergency contact information. Oh, I gotta run that by HR, says good old madam.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I'm pretty sure it's an unregulated industry. You'd kind of want to keep things a little bit covert. Not have a Rolodex of your hose.
On the DL a little bit, yeah. And so, yeah, Marcus is going to get her somewhere safe, and she's collecting her dogs when the bad guys do, in fact, burst in, guns a-blazing. A shootout happens, following them down to the street for more shooting, but ultimately they escape in Marcus's sensible family vehicle. But we do find out that the bad guys managed to clock the license plate number. Marcus is busy telling Julie that they'll...
Hold up. Did you guys think it was just a bit odd that they have Marcus's license plate number, but they never go to his house? Which is really, like, the only thing I feel like you would use a license plate number for, is to find address info that so you could, you know...
Well, yeah.
Go torture somebody's right? family.
Well, but they do go to the house, because there is the point where they're staking.
Oh, yeah.
They're staking it out. They never like, charge the house, but that they do true, stake yeah. it out.
Mm.
But, like, hello, bad guys. You abduct the cop's family.
Yeah, exactly. These are the worst bad guys in any movie I've ever seen. Like, this guy, Fouché or whatever, he can't get his heroin, like, racket right. He's got them in a moist room, and they can't even make it properly. All his thugs are just the most inept thugs I've ever seen.
They're just keeping ether everywhere in this movie.
Yeah.
Oh, man. That's not Breaking Bad at all.
No. That's right. They need Walter White in there telling them how to properly set up their cook operation, because they're just doing it all wrong. Marcus is busy telling Julie that they'll put her in protective custody, but this just isn't good enough for her. The guy who shot Max was a cop, and the only thing she knows is that Max has vouched for Mike. And she says she feels some amnesia coming on unless he takes her to his place to protect her. So, remembering he's supposed to be Mike, he takes her to Mike's place, and this is where we get to meet my favorite side character, Chet the Doorman. Chet is played by Severio Guerrero, who is it continues, who is Mocha Joe from Curb Your Enthusiasm. He makes up a bad excuse about Mike saying he could use his place and ends up having to pay Chet off. And I just like how he's extorting Marcus after he sees Julie through the window. Mr. Burnett, how's the wife and the kids? But Chet does let him go up. And okay, so what's up with that elevator?
Elevator to hell.
But like the door that opens outwards? It's such a bizarre elevator. Is this a real thing?
I've never seen anything like that. But, you know, it is Miami. Who knows?
They get up to the apartment, and we get some more clumsy, trying to act like Mike moments from Marcus, not knowing where the light switch is, or even the kitchen, for that matter, and saying stuff like, I'm always moving my switches around. But, like, here's the thing that bugs me the most about all this. Clearly, he knows Chet really well. And Chet wouldn't be the only doorman either. Presumably, that means that Marcus has visited Mike's house multiple times? How is he so clueless about the layout of the apartment? Like, I suppose, like, switches are one thing, but, like, not even being able to point out which direction the kitchen is in?
Yeah. That's odd. Maybe he remodeled. I don't know.
Yeah. Ugh. Like, Marcus is just an idiot. Like, he is so bad at this.
Again, it brings me to my point. How is he a cop?
Yeah.
How has he passed detective?
It's kind of weird, though, because Marcus actually ends up, I think, on the whole, having most of the action and, like, most of the big fights and stuff revolve around him. All of Mike's stuff is mostly at the end and that one little thing at the madam's house, but...
Yeah.
You know, they make the joke even before they go see the captain that, like, Marcus is the only one who's killed two people by that point.
Yeah. Well, Marcus / Mike, the fake Mike, leaves Julie alone at this point to make herself at home and leaves on other business, a.k.a. going home to his wife. And as he's leaving, he has another exchange with Chet, who of course says, that was fast. It's not like that, Chet. She's a witness. He tells Chet not to let Mr. Lowry upstairs without calling him first. And so Marcus goes home to his wife, who is pissed off, and makes him sleep on the couch, especially when she notes that he isn't even wearing his ring. His wife seems a little overreactive in a lot of situations, but Marcus is just terrible at getting himself out of it too. Like, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know which character here is more annoying in this fight. The wife that can't understand that, look, I've got a job to do, or Marcus who can't just come out and say, look, we had something come up.
Yeah, it's probably a combination of the two, right? Like, they both make it worse.
I just got shot at, bitch! I'm not sleeping on the couch! Like, come on, Marcus, give me some heat! So next morning at the precinct, Mike and Marcus arrive at the same time. Mike is in the back of a cop car with an ice pack held to his neck, and they start comparing bad nights, although neither of them, like, truly confides in the other about why they had a bad night. Like, they're trying to one-up each other on who had the worst night, and there's really no information exchanged. Because, like, the captain ends up berating Marcus for the gunplay the night before. First of all, you'd think there would have been some sort of debrief on this situation before the morning.
But some sort of paperwork would have had to be filed if you killed somebody.
I think so. Yeah, isn't there even a rule that they have to find and account for every bullet that was fired before they can actually be cleared of all charges or something like that? Like there's some sort of like crime scene release that does have to happen for real. But I do love the line, I haven't killed anyone today, Captain. So this is where Mike kind of gets brought up to speed. However, if he had just answered Marcus's pages, dated tech, he would already know all this. They have a witness, and apparently the drug drop will be happening in 4 days. We have 4 days, says the captain. What happened to 72 hours? Like, he had said 72 hours before the FBI and DEA shut us down, and that was a whole 24 hours ago, but somehow they found 4 more days before before they're going to get taken off the case.
They didn't think we were going to notice.
The plan regarding the witness is that Marcus will continue posing as Mike, and Mike will be staying with Marcus's family as protection, because Marcus thinks they might have gotten his license plate number, and Marcus heads home to pack, and they lie to Teresa saying that Marcus is going to a convention, but Mike will be keeping an eye on the family. Like, why the ruse? Again,
I know.
Why isn't it like, okay, we have this witness that will only talk to me, and so I have to go stay with her.
Like, that sounds like an epic lie.
But it's more realistic than anything that he's been telling her so far.
But even still, it's still, go back to my previous point, like, Marcus could have just stayed home, and they could have just told Julie, sorry, this is actually Mike.
Yeah, instead of lying to the actual spouse that he's been with for like a decade. No, let's break the news to the witness. But hey, if you want protection still, we will keep you safe. It's up to you.
Yeah. And that's what kind of bothered me about the whole thing, right? It's like this formula has been used so many times in these types of movies. It's the misunderstanding.
Yeah.
It's almost like they're trying to do too much. Like, they have enough just with the heist, the fact that, like, the cops got robbed, there was a murder, and you have to protect your one witness. They didn't really need, these guys need to experience each the other side of the fence, you know?
It's Trading Places again, Colin!
It's kind of funny, like, watching all these movies at this point. I'm just starting to notice formulas and how it's just, this movie really tries to throw in as many as it possibly can.
Exactly.
Yeah, I was never a film student, but this podcast has definitely given me an education. We get a quick scene of Fouché pissed off that his drugs aren't being cooked fast enough, and they complain it's too damp in their environment, and it's slowing them down. We've already talked about this scene. But he shoots someone to prove that he means business. Get it done! Now we go back to Mike's apartment with Marcus and see what Julie is up to. She's exploring the apartment a bit, her dogs are out of control, and she comes across a shelf full of pictures of the real Mike, and Marcus, who we've established is terrible at lying, says they're pictures of his partner, which I guess that's the truth, one for every time that he's saved his life. But she said, I thought maybe you were gay. But instead of going with it, which would have made his life simpler.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It would have made things so much easier later on when she's feeling funny.
Instead, he takes huge offense to this and has to prove his heterosexuality to her. So they go over to the computer. He takes her through mug shots and then offers her a bite of his sandwich, but she doesn't eat flesh.
I did like when he says, like, oh, haven't you been in the bed? Haven't you seen those dents?
He said that?
Like, wow, that's
some aggressive lovemaking.
Dents?
My other thought is, guy on guy action would leave dents too. Like, that by no means is proof of your thesis here, Marcus. Like,
wow. Well, I know back in the day, Martin Lawrence, he was a little controversial because I think he was quite closet homophobic.
Okay.
So, you know, I think, you know, that kind of goes towards his character. Right,
he may have improvised this line, yeah. they're going through mug shots, and she manages to pick out Fouché out of one of the mug shots, and so we get Mike and Marcus back at work together. Marcus is complaining that he's tired of the witness, whereas Mike says it's better than that zoo he calls a home. Mike looks like he's actually pretty chill at Marcus's house. Marcus at Mike's house pretending to be Mike is, like, so stressed the fuck out. But Mike actually seems to be kind of having a good time with, like, these nieces and nephews of his. Like, you know, like, quote-unquote nieces and nephews. Like, he's got to be Uncle Mike, right?
Yeah.
But Teresa calls, and Mike takes this opportunity to prank Marcus. She's asking him to bring home some stuff and then hangs up. But Mike, pissed off that Marcus is wearing his silk shirt, says, "So, what are you wearing?" Which is an absolutely great moment from Will Smith. Now it's time for the real Mike to meet Julie, which is a fun scene where he's talking about, like, man, if a dog did that to my stuff, I'd be pissed. Like, Mike is a better actor at pretending to be okay with everything than Marcus is at being Mike. And so we've got a dog on the couch, one that's been sick in Mike's bed. A woman named Yvette shows up in lingerie under her trench coat, and Marcus sends her away, further infuriating Mike. And they ultimately leave Julie alone while they go to investigate a place called Club Hell, with the captain telling them that they've got 2 days left at this point. The numbers are just jumping all over the place. That 4 days, that's a whoops, I guess. But just before they arrive, we see bad guys pull up in a truck, which we find out when one of them goes to light a smoke and getting yelled at by his partner, is full of barrels of ether. And while alone in the apartment, Julie also easily finds Mike's gun, you know, because it's nice and secure. Good job, Mike, keeping your weapons in a lockbox. She just finds one of his spare guns lying around.
Well, it is America.
I suppose so. So, Club Hell is one fucked up nightclub. Candles? An aquarium behind the bar, which is actually a window to the men's room? Like, what's going on in this club?
It sounds kind of cool, actually.
At some points, it reminded me of the club from Dusk Till Dawn.
Right? Like, yeah, it just doesn't seem like a legitimate club. But our bad boys split up, and cheesy mustache guy, who is Fouché's number two guy, spots Marcus on the crowded dance floor, and Marcus heads to the washroom, and while standing at the urinal, gets accosted by some bad guys, and that head smashing into the filthy urinal.
Oh,
it's so disturbing.
So gross.
And that's the other thing about this club, like, the mirrors are dirty, and this urinal doesn't drain, and it's...
Yeah. But yet it looks really nice with, like, the aquarium, like, if they try to... They try to make it all fancy, but yeah, it's disgusting as shit.
And this seems like it's a hot spot. Candles, guys. Like, what the fuck is going on?
That's a health concern.
That's a fire code violation. So he ends up getting thrown through that bonkers as shit fish tank. And this is when Mike, who was drinking at the bar, on duty, by the way, notices. And at this point, just to complicate matters, Julie shows up with revenge on her mind and a gun in her hand. And she's raising the gun when Mike yells out to Julie, you know, because you'd hear that in a dance club with pulsating bass. You'd hear him yelling over that. But Marcus also jumps and knocks the gun away, and we hear the gun go off while it's pointing directly into the crowd, miraculously without hitting anyone in this dense dance floor. But the sound of the gunshot is enough to make people scatter, and this is also a sound I'm not sure you'd hear over the music in a dance club. They grab Julie and they run out of there, and they end up commandeering the truck parked out front to make their escape. The truck full of ether. And so it's car chase time, but it's like high stakes car chase because of the explosive cargo. Martin Lawrence shows off more of his terrible driving acting, and Julie complains that this is protective custody? Well, maybe if you had just stayed put.
We've been safer.
Yeah. No one asked you to join.
We told you to stay here. Oh, my God. So the bad guys corner the bad boys in a dead end, but they ultimately end up blowing them up thanks to the ether that has been heavily foreshadowed. And the explosion doesn't go unnoticed by a TV news camera. We, of course, see no scene of them debriefing after a massive explosion, and they instead go to a bodega-type liquor store. Like, the sign says liquor, but they're there to get shampoo for Julie. What the hell is going on in this store?
Yeah, it sounds more like a bodega.
Yeah, like, I know you can get beer at 7-Elevens in countries that aren't ours, but this seems like a pretty wild... It says liquor outside the door. It's advertised as a liquor store.
That's how they get people to come in. Liquor, but we got everything else.
While you're here, get some Pert Plus. But while they're there, they get the idea that they need to question JoJo. And we also see that the clerk panics when he sees their guns and he pulls a gun on them. Freeze, mother bitches! I love that line.
Who says that?
The clerk, yeah. Behind the... I see. You weren't asking literally.
No, I was just saying. Who in their right mind would say that?
Oh, it's fresh off the boat talk is what it is.
Yeah, I think this is one of my... Probably my favorite scene of the movie with this guy. There's so much happening. Even the part where he's like, I've killed before, I'll kill again. And that... They don't think anything of that. Like,
yeah.
I feel like you open up an investigation at that point.
Hold on, I'm reaching for my badge. Badge? You want badge? I've got badge. 99 cents.
So, that was a horrible accent, by the way.
I wasn't trying to really do an accent. I figured I don't need to go into deep cultural appropriation territory. If Hank Azaria is no longer doing a poo, I'm not going to throw my hat into the ring on that one, you know? Mike and Marcus split up to go back to their respective wrong houses. Julie is all horned up now because of all the intense action, though, and she throws herself at Marcus, who gets all nervous, you know, even though, like, all those dents were from all his vigorous lovemaking. So it starts planting seeds of doubt that this man is who he says he is. And she starts talking about how she always expected Mike to be smoother from the way that Max talks, like his partner Marcus. Like, no wonder his wife locked that ass down. And, of course, this gets Marcus paranoid about what's going on at his real house. So he calls home, and we get more wacky misunderstanding when Mike answers the phone, but doesn't really answer the phone, like, just picks it up, because we end up hearing things like, no, put it back in, Mike, even though they're only talking about a photo album of embarrassing photos. But jumping to the wrong conclusion, Marcus overreacts and decides he needs to go check on him. And logically, he takes Julie with him instead of leaving her safe at home. I guess she broke his trust or something by coming to Club Hell. Oh, and of course, because he can't let her know his true identity, he handcuffs her to the steering wheel while he heads off to sneak a peek in the windows. And meanwhile, from down the street, some bad guys sitting in a car are watching this all play out and wondering, like, what's this guy doing? Marcus sneaking across the lawn, peeking in main floor windows, and then climbing up to look in upper floor windows. However, Marcus ends up falling into the trash cans, and this gets Mike's attention in the house, who tells Teresa to get the kids safe and chases after the perp, only to tackle him and find out that it's Marcus. And then Mike scolds him, saying, how could he think he'd do anything? Now, just get out of here. You're supposed to be at a convention. But as he walked away from soaking wet from getting tackled in a kiddie pool, all I could think of is how badly is Mike going to freak out when he finds out he took that wetness back into his Porsche?
Oh, yeah.
I never thought of that.
That's all I can think about. Is it's like he's soaking wet, and oh, that Porsche. That poor Porsche. First he spills food, and now he's like getting in, soaking wet.
That's a dick move.
I was just thinking, do they ever explain why he has the Porsche? Because the first time that he has Julie, he has the van or whatever.
The Volvo.
I guess they probably needed to return the Volvo so that she could look after her kids.
Well, she does have that line in The Escape where she says, oh my god, there's a kid seat in the back, right? So yeah. Teresa might have needed it because it had the car seats in it. You can't haul kids around town in the Porsche. Like, the Burnetts only have one car between them, maybe? Yeah. I don't know.
Oh.
One thing I noticed about this movie, because like I was looking at cars for my sponsorship corner, is that cars switch around a lot in this movie. Like, the bad guys have a lot of cars. Like, because at one point they're driving like Ford Broncos, and then later it's like Chevy Tahoes. Like, it's like they have like this seemingly endless supply, fleets of cars.
They're bad guys. You know how quick it is to, have you not seen Gone in 60 Seconds?
Yeah.
You gotta get a new car every minute.
Oh, bringing in the Jerry Bruckheimer tie-in for this.
There you go.
Yeah. But on the upside, Marcus's jealous invasion does get the guys in the car that are watching down the street busted by the backup of Sanchez and Ruiz, so I guess there was an upside. We cut to a weird interrogation scene of these two guys in, like I mentioned before, in a room that doesn't even look like an interrogation room. It looks like, you know, a stairwell or something. I don't know.
It's like a shed. Guantanamo.
But it's the way this scene plays out that comes across as really bizarre. Like, it just cuts in on them like questioning. It's already well underway, and Sanchez or Ruiz, I don't remember which, just screaming at the guy, I'll ask you one last time, give me a goddamn name. And like at that point the guy cracks. Like, it's so low stakes, but this guy is all like, oh well, this is the last time you'll ask, I better tell you everything I know then. Like, they're not even threatening pain or anything like that. But we also get an update from Internal Affairs that there have been calls to Club Hell from this precinct. Bum, bum, bum! The plot thickens. They go back to Jojo to try to get more info, whether he's heard of anyone who's been cutting drugs. Well, why do they bring Julie everywhere now? Like, they handcuff her to the steering wheel to go talk to Jojo.
It's odd.
So, of course, in typical movie informants style, he says he doesn't know anything. But Mike, however, has different plans. He pulls a gun on Jojo. And when Marcus tries to get between them, Mike also pulls a gun on him. So Marcus, in a whole bunch of overacting, tells Jojo, oh, he's on his own. You know, I tried to stop him, Jojo, but oh, Jojo, just tell him. Yeah, this was one of those scenes where I found Marcus particularly annoying.
I also didn't understand his the like do-rag that he's got going on in that scene. It's just
why so gangster all of a sudden?
Yeah, he's like all hooded up, and yeah, like his wardrobe in this movie is like so varied. Like, there's the one scene where he's wearing like that quilted vest. It's like you said earlier about like what is the dress code. Apparently there is none for anyone outside of uniform.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like these guys would get shot just because if all their backup came in the heat of the moment, you might not really know who's who.
Yeah.
Totally.
But, I mean, maybe it's an intimidation tactic. Like, maybe it's an extra scare factor for Jojo. Who knows? Anyway, since Mike is crazy enough to pull a gun on his partner, he's clearly crazy enough to actually shoot Jojo. And so it helps convince Jojo to just crumble and spill all the beans. Now Julie is off to do some more police work with her two police sidekicks as they stake out a boat based on the information Jojo gave. But because Julie isn't actually a trained cop, when she demands to sneak a look through the binoculars at the boat, Fouché spots her and knows that the cops are onto him. And so we cut to Marcus's kids watching TV, and they see the news report from the night before with the explosion on the bridge. Like, like, and doesn't it come in as like breaking news? And it's like, this happened like 12 hours ago, didn't it? Or are the kids watching the news?
No, they say in the news report it happened two nights ago.
I know. So I was confused.
Yeah. So yeah, on the news report, we see that Mike and Marcus are clearly present, and so the kids scream for their mom. Well, Teresa easily figures out that Marcus is at Mike's place. I like watching her storm past Chet, who can't stop her. There's also a moment earlier, I don't remember exactly where, but Mike and Marcus both come in with Julie, and Chet is all, Mr. Lowry, as he greets them. Well, Marcus and Mike have been getting ready to go on a mission, so they're both not fully dressed when Teresa knocks on the door, which Julie answers, and she says, I'm here for my husband, Marcus. Is he the tall one or the short one? Short. Figures. So, as Marcus is clumsily trying to talk his way out of the lie, Julie collects her dogs and storms out, and Mike chases after her and catches her in the elevator. The trust has been broken. They only care about their heroine, not Max's murder. And if his wife found us, how much longer will it take before the bad guys do? And we find out, not very long, because as they get to the lobby, the bad guys are coming in the front door. Teresa, who is also stormed out shortly after Julie, arrives in the lobby in the second elevator with Marcus still trying to explain things. And then there's a moment of calm before all hell breaks loose in the lobby. Teresa gets pushed to safety. The room is getting shot up. Chet is hiding behind the desk with the dogs calling 911. I love his phone call, though. Hey, this is Chet. We need backup. And then he hangs up and says, oh, I forgot to give them the address. He just calls in, hey, it's Chet.
Well, everybody knows Chet.
Everybody. In the end, Julie gets abducted, and there's a foot chase for a while with the bad guys pulling Julie along. Julie should have just stopped running. She should have just become dead weight, you know? But I also don't fully understand, why do they want Julie so bad?
Because they want to, maybe something will happen.
Yeah, sure.
Bring her along. Maybe, you know, something will happen.
But it's like, just shoot her. You already shot the cabbie. Just shoot her. That's the whole point, is killing this witness. It's like you said earlier about Mike getting thrown through the window by a sledgehammer guy. Just shoot him. I've got a gun in my room. We'll do it together. So we get Mike pursuing in some glorious slow motion shots. I love how only Mike shots are slow motion shots of like him sprinting and jumping over cars with his gun pulled, like real hero shots.
Yeah, and also there was that scene where, wasn't it that same scene where he's like running, like his shirt's undone, and he's running bare chested, slow motion. Come on.
So the bad guys all pile into the stolen taxi. Mike's still chasing them on foot in slow motion. Marcus chasing too. And in the end, Marcus has to be saved in the middle of the street from being run over by the bad guys in the nick of time by Mike. And so we cut back to their precinct, where they have a hacker trying to open a sealed file on Eddie Dominguez that we've been seeing a bit throughout the movie, but I haven't mentioned. Earlier, it was trying to be accessed by the secretary, Francine. But we find out why it took Francine so long. Because they've brought in the big guns, literally, because when this guy stands up, he's like 7 feet tall. So this is the ex-Detroit Pistons player. His name is John Sally. I really do like, though, the point of view camera angle of Marcus acting tough. Like, it's the very funny sight gag of like him looking up into the guy's face. It's a great shot.
Yeah.
So when he manages to hack the file, we find out some very juicy info. Francine, the secretary, is listed as Eddie's girlfriend. Oh, snap! She was the mole! I do find it interesting, though, that girlfriend is listed in his file.
Like, the only way that would be listed if it was an emergency contact.
Emergency contact, next of kin, yeah. Like, but just girlfriend? Like, spouse, I understand, but your girlfriend could change every month. So they question Francine, and we get a tearful, I didn't know what I was doing, and they threaten me type excuse for herself. And at this point, Internal Affairs has taken them off the case. But they continue to work it anyway, because, you know, they're rebel cops. They recruit Sanchez and Ruiz as backup for this rogue mission, which I'm glad they did. It makes it slightly more realistic than just the two of them going on this mission. At least they have backup. From Francine, they've gotten a cell phone number, which they start triangulation on. I like when he phones him up and he's like, hey, is Elvis there? And he says, sorry, you got the wrong number, but it's long enough to triangulate the position. So I guess all those other movies that tell us you need to keep them on the line for 30 seconds.
They got the wrong tech.
they do. They need to go to the Miami PD tech department. We find out their position is it's a private airport. Our bad boys suit up to go save the day. The guy that the bad guys are selling to is, he's one Jon Favreau looking motherfucker in a white suit. Like, that guy, like, I'm just like, that looks so Jon Favreau. But like in 1995, yeah. Jon Favreau was still kind of skinny. So, yeah. Like, that looks like, it either looks like Jon Favreau or it looks like the guy that played Angel in Dexter. Like, that's the other guy that he looks like. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Once they've had a chance to stake out the scene and suiting up in their police bulletproof vests in the trunk, I've always wondered, like, how many cops actually in their own personal vehicles have like one of these layouts in their trunk where it's like you have the brackets for your weapons and everything. Like, this Porsche can't be an official police car, right?
Yeah, no. I don't think a lot of cops use their personal vehicle as a work vehicle.
Yeah, it reminds me of like the Winchesters on Supernatural. You know, the back, and it's like they have all their guns and rifles.
Yeah. But once they've had a chance to stake out the scene, glancing at a nearby garbage truck, Mike comes up with a plan that, quote, always works sometimes. So the big action finale kicks into high gear, garbage truck crashing into the hangar, guns are fired, people are dying, explosions everywhere, plus one-liners like, you forgot your boarding pass, and the good guys are getting shot, but inconsequentially, Julie, who stole a handcuff key earlier, gets away from her kidnapper and joins the fray. She crashes the car she's driving with a, you know, the old tuck and roll maneuver out the door into the more barrels of ether.
How did more people not die from explosions of ether?
But they've already cooked all the drugs. Are they transporting ether too? Like, did they throw in the ether as like, hey, it's a special deal we've got. You buy all my heroin and we'll throw in the ether for free, you know?
Like, they overbought. They actually ordered a double shipment of ether. It's crazy too, because they have that warehouse is just full of ether all around their plane. Yep. And everything, and this cargo, all their vehicles. It just seems so dangerous.
And people, like, were smoking everywhere. Like, yeah, how does that not, like, combust?
So much ether. Yes. Whoever was on the purchase order for that moved a decimal point or ordered too many gallons of ether. Marcus, though, has gotten Mike's Porsche and rescued them just as everything explodes. And Julie, also, they get out of there just in the nick of time. And Fouché has also gotten into a hot little sports car and is trying to escape. So they chase after him. And this turns into the most high-stakes game of chicken ever as they cruise down the runway toward a concrete barrier wall that only has a gap big enough for one car to fit through. Marcus is busy reciting Miranda rights, and Mike says, "What are you doing? Getting it out of the way."
Getting it out of the way.
So, man, there's some like really, really cheesy lines in this last
30 minutes.
Yeah. And of course, like, his hands are twitching back and forth on that steering wheel like a motherfucker, because Martin Lawrence isn't the best at pretending how to drive. But Mike, who, as you may remember, told Marcus earlier that he's a slow driver, is busy telling him to punch it, and repeats something from the opening scene about this being the fastest car on the market. You can beat him, but you have to go for it. And so at the last moment, Fouché gets edged out of the way. Our heroes are okay, and Fouché spins out and smashes into the barrier, and Marcus slams on the brake. And now we get the hero shot from the poster of our bad boys and Julie walking towards Fouché. More nice Michael Bay slow-mo action, and we've got that yellow filter on the camera lens. And
there's that one weird shot when Fouché is like running away. It's like a close-up on Will Smith in the barrel of the gun, and Julie's face is uncomfortably close to his.
Yeah.
almost like she's just gonna whisper into his ear, like, "Do it, Mike. Do it."
And she's probably standing on like a melt crate or something, because Will Smith is tall. So Fouché has crumpled out of the car, and he starts trying to run away. And even though there hasn't been the most regard for police procedure up to this point, you know, no gloves, no debriefs, Miranda rights without the perp and earshot, he does at this point at least yell, "Freeze!" And like, doesn't he even give a warning shot?
Yeah, because everybody freezes when they say freeze.
Yeah,
he does. He doesn't give a warning shot, but I think he says freeze twice.
Yeah,
and then he shoots him in the kneecap.
Yeah, he takes out Fouché's knee instead of killing him, which is what he really wants to do, and has done a few times in this movie, just killing willy-nilly, blowing people up with ether. Fouché collapses, and here's another weird camera angle, is as he's collapsing, there's like this crane shot that goes up to like watch as he like collapses into this circle.
Yeah, very dramatic.
Fouché collapses, and our two cops are standing over him with guns drawn, and they kick the gun away, and we get the moment with Mike on the verge of killing him, but getting talked down by Marcus. They've got to properly arrest him. But come on, this is an action movie from the 90s. So of course we're going to have the talking down your partner. This is the Brad Pitt 7 what's in the box moment, you know?
What this actually reminded me a lot of was the end of Lethal Weapon when after Riggs just has a fist fight with that guy and whatever, and you think it's all over.
Yep. Because of course, like Lethal Weapon, like Die Hard, we get our last minute bad guy pop-up cliche, pulling a hidden gun out while the cops are celebrating, but they see him and shoot him dead. Boom! Fouché is fucking toast. Finally.
He unloads his entire clip into him. Doesn't even just shoot. It's the thing that also killed me is, like, at that point, you can see that other police are now approaching the scene.
Yeah.
But still, there's no conversation afterwards about, hey, that might have been, that didn't really seem like equal force.
Yeah, it's time for our wrap-up now. So like Colin said, there's cops all over now. Marcus has been patched up for his gunshot wound. The bad boys tell each other, I love you, man. Apparently Will Smith really didn't want to tell him that he loves him. Like, he fought Michael Bay for a long time with this. I don't understand. I don't know why.
Because he thought it would be too cheesy?
I don't know. It's such a bizarre bit of trivia that I found out, that Will Smith really fought this I love you, man. And then Marcus, who is going home to his wife, handcuffs Mike to Julie, to which neither of them or any of the other surrounding cops has a key. And credits. The end. And that is Bad Boys. Now, Colin Kingsley, on IMDb, it scored 6.9 out of 10 and a Metascore of 41. On Rotten Tomatoes, it has 42% on the tomato meter and an audience rating of 78%. But, Colin, those are just numbers. What you gonna do, buddy?
What you gonna do when the reviewers come for you? I was pretty struck by the disparity between the audience and the critics on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah,
I mean, I shouldn't have been. It's almost the exact type of movie that you would expect this, because in my opinion, the critics, they have no place in reviewing a movie. They can never review a movie like this fairly.
Yeah.
Because I mean, we've talked a lot of shit about how things don't make sense, but really at the end of the day, if you're going to try to review of this movie and decide if people should go watch it, that's just, like, the name of the game for this genre, so...
Yeah, it seems like also if you want to actually have any street cred as a critic, you can't admit that you like a movie like this.
Yeah, exactly. That's true.
So that being said, I decided to go with the audience reviews for this one, so here we go. From Google Play, Brad Brookhart says, in true Michael Bay fashion, the film almost has more guns, car chases, and explosions than one knows what to do with. Also, why is there so much ether in Miami?
Yes. Fuck, that's exactly what I've been talking about. Fucking ether.
Rotten Tomatoes user Samuel L. gave it 3 out of 5 stars. He says, despite some stupidity related to the plot and characters, like police officers wearing normal clothing almost all the time, Bad Boys is an entertaining action film with some funny moments. The acting was solid, the quality of the plot is forgivable due to the enjoyment factor, and the cinematography was acceptable, but with too many cuts and places from what I recall. The action was unrealistic but fun to watch, the visual effects were good for the time, and the soundtrack matched the tone of the film. And then, let me know what you think of this line. He says, Bad Boys is arguably worth a watch.
Arguably?
I guess maybe they're just trying to sound fancy. Like, the, you know, this is an audience reviewer that he's trying to use big words that a critic would use. I feel like he's like, arguably, that sounds smart.
Yeah, exactly. And then the last one I have is from Paul F. He gave it 4.5 stars out of 5. He said, this movie is a template for many, many, many Michael Bay and buddy cop movies that followed. Massive explosions? Check. Witty banter during a gunfight? Check. Unnecessary accent for the main villain? Check. Movie career-sparking turn for Will Smith? Check. It has it all. Yes, there were fun partner cop movies before this. Example, Beverly Hills Cop, Lethal Weapon. But the combination of cinematic slick action set a new standard.
Yeah, the funny thing is, the comment on there about the bad guy with the unnecessary accent, I'm pretty sure that's the actor's actual accent.
This is normal accent.
Yeah, that's his actual accent, yeah.
Yeah, considering his name was, like, I can't even remember.
Chicksmagully of something.
I think he was the one whose last name sounds like Caillou.
So yeah, that's overall, like, from what I read, again, like, the audience reviews, there were some that were negative. Oh, I read a surprising amount of reviews that said that Will Smith and Martin Lawrence didn't have good chemistry.
Yeah.
Which I thought, I don't know. I guess I can kind of see it. I thought they had good chemistry. I just felt at certain points their characters were doing things that didn't make sense, especially Marcus. But
yeah. Yeah, I feel like it's not so much lack of chemistry as it is that Marcus is kind of an annoying character in this equation.
Yeah, because it seems like they liked making this movie enough, and that, like, Will Smith and Martin Lawrence liked working together enough that
they'll,
you know, they
more?
Made Bad Boys, yeah. They made Bad Boys 2 and then worked for a really long time to get Bad Boys 3 made. So if there was no chemistry, they probably wouldn't have chosen to do that, to make those sequels.
No, probably not.
Yeah, it's true.
So, yeah, like I said, 6.9 on IMDb and 78% on Rotten Tomatoes for audience, and then the 41 and 42 for the critics. Kingsley, where does this fall for you on this rewatch?
I'm going to have to give it an overall score of like 6 out of 10. Yeah. And the reason, and, you know, this was brought up when Colin was reading some of the reviews, but, you know, after watching things like Lethal Weapon, Beverly Hills Cop, and then later on, you know, like the Rush Hour series, right? So all these buddy cop buddy movies, right? Those were some of the good ones. This one, I didn't think it was as good because I think the chemistry was there, but I think there was a lot of the plot lines and just even trying to suspend my disbelief. Some of it was just so stupid, but yeah. It's hard to ignore, right? And the only reason why I gave it more of a passing grade, it's all Taylor Leone. Otherwise, this would have been a 4 out of 10, but. She made it worthwhile. Yeah. She looked great. And,
she bumped that up a couple points.
Yeah, she definitely bumped it up. And,
nice. Yeah.
I know I've said this before on this show. I feel like at this point I could almost get this made into a t-shirt, but I think I like the other ones more.
Other Bad Boys?
Yeah, I just looking at this franchise together, I agree with what you're saying with, you know, I love Rush Hour and I love Lethal Weapon. Like, I love those movies. But Lethal Weapon 1 was one where I'm like, I think it's the other ones that I like more than this one. And that's kind of how I felt about this one, is I'm pretty sure the second and third one are more fun.
I think also, like, the later ones, it's better technology and also better cinematography. I think also lends to, you know, watching it and enjoyability, right?
Yeah, like, knowing this is Michael Bay's debut movie, and I know that Jordan on our Con Air episode made a joke about it's generous for you to call Michael Bay a director. I do see, though, that he has actually grown as a director, because this being his debut, it's not as solid as some of the things that he has done in the future.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it definitely launched some careers, right? Including this, probably.
Colin, so this is your first viewing. I didn't think we were going to catch you on another first viewing when it came to this movie, but that's great to find out. What is your thought on Bad Boys?
I think you really need to enjoy Michael Bay to like this movie.
Yeah.
And I mean, I do sometimes, but it's like, for me, Michael Bay is like, you have to be in the mood for Michael Bay. and you can't, and you just can't like critique it too much. So it's kind of almost similar to Down to Earth and how I feel about it. Is like on the first watch, I thought it was great. It's just like a no-nonsense, like explosions, action, like all that goodness.
It's a warm blanket.
Yeah, it's just a warm blanket of ether. But it's like the minute you start really nitpicking it, it all just unravels before your eyes. Like, and so because of that, I think I would probably like be around King. I'd probably give it like a 5 out of 10. I don't think it's bad. It's definitely worth a watch. And I mean, I like Will Smith a lot. I thought I liked Martin Lawrence. Mm-hmm. Like, I've liked Martin Lawrence in some movies, but he's kind of hit or miss with me. Like, he's either okay or he's just super annoying, and I found him very annoying in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's how I feel about Kevin Hart. In the same way, where it's like, okay, sometimes I like Kevin Hart. Kevin Hart was great in Jumanji, especially the second one where he's playing the old man. Like, that one was absolutely great, but, like, then there's some movies where it's just like, ooh, I don't think I like Night School very much. That's
you can
sure.
get annoyed.
Yeah, for sure.
And then, but then even considering Michael Bay, like you were saying with Con Air, it's interesting because I love Con Air and I love The Rock. Well, like, well, those are two of...
Con Air wasn't directed by Michael Bay, just to remind you, yeah. That was done by another first-time music video director.
Oh, okay.
I guess Jerry Bruckheimer likes that. I just remember Michael Bay's name coming up in the episode, and that was the joke that Jordan made, yeah.
Oh, right. But yeah, so like, and I mean, this movie actually reminds me of the later Transformer movies. I think it could have benefited by being shorter.
Yeah.
But it's like Michael Bay just has the need for like more explosions and more car chases and more guns, that he just inflates his movies with all this fluff. And when you have just a sliver of a story there, it's really hard to hang on for the ride.
Ironically, the fact that you say though that this could have benefited from being shorter, this is Michael Bay's shortest movie, clocking in at 1 hour and 59 minutes. Everything else that he's ever directed is over 2 hours long. So,
no, for sure. I remember watching Transformers. I think it's the fourth one. The first one that has Mark Wahlberg. Okay, and I was literally sitting watching this movie, and I reached a point, and I was like, oh, we're starting a new movie now. But yeah, so... I mean, it's definitely worth the watch, and after watching it, I kind of do want to go. I haven't seen Bad Boys for Life, so I would like to watch Bad Boys 2 again, and then see how things are wrapped up in Bad Boys for Life.
Yeah, I think they're better.
Those sequels are better.
Yeah, I did watch Bad Boys for Life when it came out, and yeah, I mean, it's pretty good, but at least, like, Martin Lawrence has at least, like, calmed down a little bit in his older age, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I almost wish, I mean... You can't do anything, but it's just I kind of wish that they could have subbed Martin Lawrence for like Chris Rock
or somebody like that.
But then that would have just been like a Lethal Weapon. Like, didn't Chris Rock show up in Lethal Weapon 3?
Oh, maybe
he did. No, Lethal Weapon 4. Yeah.
Four.
There's just something about Martin Lawrence that on his best day I find him okay. And any other time I'm just like, I don't want to see you in a movie.
Yeah, that list that I listed with his credits of like Black Knight and Blue Streak, and I've seen some of those, and he's not a big draw for me either.
You could say he was quite ethereal.
Ethereal.
And right there, that's got to be the punchline we go out on. So there we go. That is Bad Boys, and that's our show for this week. Oh, wow. A big thank you to our special guest, Kingsley Long. Thank you for coming back and hanging out with us for another couple hours here.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me again. It's cool.
Do we want to sing this one out, boys? Bad boys, bad boys.
What you gonna do?
What you gonna do
when they come for you?
Oh, wow. That is tough to do over Zoom.
Yeah, it's very tough.
So if you like that show, one thing you can do to really help us out on the business end is to tell your friends. Share our posts. Word of mouth is the lifeblood of a podcast trying to get noticed in the huge sea out there. Or if you want to go above and beyond, I've got something to tell you, friends. We have cracked the top 100 for movie review podcasts on Apple. So if you want to go above and beyond and you haven't given us a review to help get us up those charts, help us climb higher than our current position. Help get us into the top 10, guys. Go give us 5 stars in a review. Doesn't matter what you say. It's not for our egos, but it's those 5 stars that drive us up the charts and help us get noticed.
And check out our website, www.iuselikethisone.com. There you can find links to all our podcast episodes, as well as all our social media sites. We have Facebook, we have Twitter, we have Instagram. Sean is constantly on there sharing sweet memes that he's made, very funny. So go on there, give him some likes, give him some comments, let us know what you think about the show.
And if you would like to be a producer of the show and donate us, you can go to patreon.com/IUsedToLikeThisOne, become part of our Patreon community. Don't forget, I threw down the challenge of 10 new patrons for our Patreon, and Colin and I will do a bonus episode watching Lavalantula. So go over there and become part of our family. I Used to Like This One is created by, hosted by, and produced by Sean Wells and Colin Stewart. It is edited by Sean Wells. Music by Lyndon Carter. Look for his band, Carter in the Capitals, anywhere you listen to music. Thank you for listening. And join us next week when we take a look at another movie on I Used to Like This One.